We have now the session of February 9, 1977. Two books have been brought to my attention. Those two books are idiorhythmic novels. It's a novel that stages idiorhythmic problems. Des Enfants Terribles by Cocteau. We are in a room in which children live in freedom. It's a communal room, whereas shortly we'll be looking at the single room, the kellyan, the cellar. The second book that people mentioned is another novel about life in a sanatorium, Les Captifs by Joseph Cassel, 1920. I return to the study of the features of living together. I now call this bureaucracy. We have seen that in the wild period, unregulated period of idiorhythmy in Egypt with Anthony, idiorhythmy was not structured in any way. The sole communal activities were weekly prayers and the direct exchange of labor, the products of labor, mats for bread. That unregulated state of idiorhythmy is characterized by the absence of bureaucracy. It's a system that is not a system. There is no state power, not even in embryonic form. There's absolutely no reified, institutionalized, objectified relay between the individuals and the microgroup. In the birth of Cenobitism in Egypt, with the Egyptian Anachorets, we see an immediate and concomitant emergence of a bureaucratic apparatus, at least to regulate material tasks. Executive agents had to change every week. They were a seminier. And we see this in the rule of Saint Benedict in the Western world. The bureaucratic deity lies in wait for the merest hint of an idiorhythmic grouping, and it swoops down upon it at the moment it starts to take. For instance, on Mount Athos, the Skites, which is the generic term for all idiorhythmic groupings, whether they are masculine or feminine, Skites. It's a word that's in the masculine or the feminine, depending on whether you speak Greek or Russian. In Greek is the word asceterion that has given asketeri. It's a place where ascesis is practiced. In the Skites, small idiorhythmic groupings, we have a college that delegates people who are its representatives They were called the epitropes. Here we see the beginning of a bureaucracy. Another example that's very different. In the 1920s, there was a desire for communes in the modern secular sense. Where did that happen? It may be extraordinary today, but in Russia, in the years immediately following the October Revolution, there was a kind of sexual revolution. There were laws passed on divorce, abortion, unmarried couples, communes. These communities met several difficulties. They were described by Wilhelm Reich. Reich describes a community, a commune, around 1925, a commune of friends near Leningrad. They cannot return to their families, and they set up a home, their home in the second story of a big house. Immediately, there were problems, obstructions that can stall everyday life, not doing the washing up, making noise at night. And then this immediately led to meetings, never-ended discussions. Each meeting would generate a commission. The institution of the commission was the fatal and absurd outcome of all those meetings. There is that circle. A meeting leads to a commission, the commission leads to a report, and then to a filing cabinet, especially in research institutions, you have commissions for every aspect of daily life. They never yield anything. And they are just called the morgue when you reach the filing cabinet. Here you have a very free community, but they couldn't help creating commissions. Commissions for everything, for every aspect of daily life. The tea commission, the soap commission, the toothpaste commission, the clothes commission. Reich writes, as far as its organization was concerned, then the commune took over the form of a state government, that is, a government by commission. I quote this because the true aporia in the structure radiorhythmic is when it reaches a dead end. We have needs to satisfy, and that we have to find agents in charge of meeting those needs. Either there's a gradual delegation of power, the creation of new posts, commissioners. Immediately, there is the risk that they crystallize and hold real power. Or there is a rotation. Everyone takes a turn. This is the Semeniers system. No power, it's only weekly power, but there are frictions, there's conflict, there's chaos, and this is a problem that I'm don't know how to resolve. This is about bureaucracy. I now come to a slightly longer entry, the word cause, with lots of quotes. Let's remind ourselves once again. Idiorhythmics are small, flexible groups of several individuals who are attempting to live together within a certain proximity to one another. The question is, what brings them together? Why do they want to be together? At first, let's make a distinction between the motive, the objective determination, the causality, the cause with a small c, the why of the movement, and the end, the goal, the object, the idea that fascinates, attracts, the cause with a capital C. In three words, the forward purpose, the telos. I'd like to talk about the telos. I call it cause because there is an ambiguity. The lower C cause and the upper C cause. And it's a thing, a chose, the thing that one invests in. This is the object of the grouping. Why were they these Christian groupings? What was it for Christians? The telos of the group is simple. One can reach perfection more easily in a small group. One wants to become a saint. One can see that Augustine wanted to become a saint, and Saint Benedict, as a student, fled Rome, retreated to Enfide near Tivoli, to practice asceticism. He founded a colony of ascetics. This was the telos, the idea of perfection. Historical determination is that the individual subject is governed by a hierarchically structural power. Power is trying to dominate isolated subjects. The cenobium, the convent, contains the individual disorder. Why then the wish to have small groups? Why these organizations with idiorhythmic tendencies? What is the telos within the sphere of Christianity? Here we must distinguish between the Orient and the Occident. In the Orient, there was true idiorhythmy. While there are economic reasons, justifications, nominal exchange of services, for instance, basket work and bread. And one shouldn't be too far from one another. That's the economic determination. But the telos is essentially mystical. The point of oriental idiorhythmy is not to achieve perfection. There is no pneumatology. The idea is to breathe together. In the Occident, it's very different. The Occident has resisted the idea of idiorhythmy. It's the opposite. The contemplative telos is consigned to monasteries. This is a tradition that is still active. We see it in Vatican II. One distinguishes contemplative institutions, convents, from apostolic institutions. Institutions, associations that have a certain action, like preaching in fraternal communities. You have the monks on the one hand, the brothers on the other hand. The structures that would be idiorhythmic will not do it for contemplation, but for a telos of charity. We see this in the third order's beguinage, as we've seen. They follow a rule that is not a monastic rule, but the rule of Saint Augustine. In literature, there is an excellent example of idiorhythmy. At least, it is subjected to the rule of Saint Augustine. It's at the beginning of the 19th century. It's the tale by Balzac called The Reverse of Contemporary History. It's a beautiful story. There's a group of people living in an old house near Notre Dame Cathedral. They live together under the supervision of a woman, Madame de la Chantrie. Here, the telos is to do good works. Charity is the telos, connected with the idiorhythmic structure. That's for the field of Christianity. In other groups, there are other sorts of telos. In all microgroups with idiorhythmic tendencies, there's always a certain telos, often expressed by a vague term, we might say a mana word. For instance, in the hippie communities that we've had in France or in the US, people who go to a farm, when they're asked why they're grouped there, they all say happiness. Here the example of two different sorts of telos. First, in a sanatorium, like the Magic Mountain. Let's rehearse the distinction I was proposing between determination, causality, and telos, what draws people in, the common goal that fascinates, that's invested in. Putting sick people together has an objective cause. On the face of it, it protects society from contagion. It exploits the taboo, sends people away. And like any hospital, there's a standardization of healthcare. The ostensible goal was to cure, to preserve life. But the goal that is invested in, the fascinating telos, the cause with a capital C, is death. The fascination is for death as the telos. The Magic Mountain talks about the fascination for death. Death in a sanatorium is what everybody is thinking about, but everybody thinks about it, but nobody would speak about it. That's the sign of a telos. There was a taboo about speaking about it, creating fascination. The fascination was about an object, death. There was an incomplete foreclosure. That's the category of the indirect would be interesting to study. The presence of death was indicated by a series of indirect, domestic, silly signs. For instance, the oxygen canisters outside the doors of those who are going to die. In the moribundi, where noticed death was present in a liminal manner as a form of housekeeping. Another feature that it was a curious dialectic between illness, the disease, that is death, and diseases, illnesses, in a plural. Those illnesses were on the side of life, on the side of struggles, of worries. The other diseases were denied. Here, I quote, "It's not advisable to fall ill up here. You aren't taken any notice of. Hans Castorp isn't even allowed to have a cold. Illnesses are negated, but the illness is the slow contemplative approach of death. In the sanatorium, there's a representation of eternity, an analogon of eternity. At the beginning, when the hero enters into the sanatorium, he has the fantasy of leaving. It's a process of calculation, supputation, estimation, when he will escape. It's a kind of military service, but the demob date hasn't been set. Then the subject settles into perpetuity. Hans is only wrenched from this eternity, from this fascination with death, by the actual death. What takes him out from the sanatorium, one needs the war of 1914. Naturally, death is present in the group. There's a statistical representation of the risk of death, the chance of your neighbor dying. Bearing in mind that your neighbor could be you. This is totally implicit. Another example of telos, this is a banal paradigm, eros. The group has as its object eros. The text that might be used would be sad. In Sainte-Marie des Bois, in Justine, and the castle in the 120 days of Sodom. It's an eccentric example, because in those two salient places, there's a foreclosure of idiorhythmy. There's no rhythmos. Of course, no rhythmos for the victims, that goes without saying. And no rhythmos for the libertines. They accept a meticulously timed schedule. They are subjected to obsessively absurd rituals and implacable rhythm. It's the Cenobium. The Sadian castle has as its model the convent, not at all an idiorhythmic space. Nevertheless, we need to keep that example in our dossier because it can allow us to identify a kind of law. You have maniacal investments here, the maniacal reasons to get together lead to the cenobitic form. On the other hand, in order for idiorhythmy to be, or the dream of idiorhythmy, there has to be a diffuse, vague, uncertain cause, a floating telos. Sad's libertines, this is their paradox, turn fantasy into the law, into a faith. From that point on, there's no longer any rhythmos. Freedom isn't a matter of sex, but of the indirect ways we invest in it. It's a squaring of the circle. The group mustn't prohibit eros, but it must be sure to assign it in an indirect position, where it's not illegal, but illegal. This indirect eros is something we see in many small communities. The failure of many modern communes comes from the fact that they put sex in the wrong position. Sexuality is either foreclosed or made indirect. The telos of all the forms of cenobitism presupposes a certain faith. In Sad, there is a faith in eros. The telos leads to a form of, it goes without saying, a discourse of arrogance, like Saint Basil of Caesarea. Faith is a definite unhesitating consent to God's teaching, with a full conviction of the truth of what is proclaimed and taught by the grace of God. On the other hand, the idiorhythmic attempt is a suspension of discourse. It's a matter of, you might say, a suspension of judgment, an epoche. Here, I would mention the hypothesis put forward by Bion, the psychoanalyst, who has mentioned it in a parapsychoanalytic way. It's a book called Experiences in Groups and Other Papers from 1961. He was a doctor who worked with small groups of sick people. The telos is connected with what Bion calls the basic hypothesis or basic assumption, the common goal that brings the group together. What is the basic assumption? For Bion, there are three basic assumptions. Each does not correspond to a distinctive type of group. All three can sometimes be successively mobilized within the space of a group. Say, in 1 hour, there will be a shimmering of all three objectives. Here are the three assumptions. First, there is what Bion calls the dependency assumption. The group meets to obtain security from a leader upon whom they depend for material and spiritual nourishment and protection. The leader can be mediated by an idea, a cause. It's certain that some causes can provide subsistence and protection. This is the case in monasteries. The second assumption, the most original, the most interesting, is what he calls the pairing assumption. Bion says that as soon as two subjects in a group, in a small group, become involved with each other, even if it's temporary, you have a production of the image of the couple, the figure of marriage. The group starts anticipating an event to come. This is dependent upon the leader having not emerged yet. There's the idea that sooner or later there will be an idea or a person who will save the group. It's a messianic hope. It's the telos of awaiting. The couple crystallizes something that is different from the true leader, but they have the same hope. The third assumption is the fight-flight assumption. The group meets to fight an outside threat or to escape it. The leader is someone whose exigencies provide the group with opportunities for fight or flight. Otherwise, he's not followed. Again, any group can switch between three basic assumptions two or three times within an hour. Bion's categories are not directly applicable to living together. They pertain to provisional groups, such as meetings, classes, and they require verbalization. They can partially, fleetingly, be relevant to certain episodes of everyday communal living. A group of friends sharing a house for the holidays. We can observe this, all of us, even at an evening with friends. It would be interesting to study the mobility of these hypotheses. One has to work in a subtle manner. You see changes in leaders, you see the effects of pairing, and you see movements of fight or flight. There's a space we're all familiar with that corresponds with Bion's small group, the weekly seminar. If it is a small seminar with 10 to 15 people, one will observe similar assumptions. You will see intellectual fights, you will see complicity, pairings, we see subjects asserting themselves through their dependence on the reader, who isn't necessarily, who isn't always, continuously the person teaching the doctor in the case of Bion small groups. Bion belonged to the groups he was studying as a doctor, but he was not the leader. The leader is not necessarily the one who is invested with authority. Bion's contribution was to point out the extreme mutability and subtlety of leadership. It's something to be studied. I invite every one of us to do this and to study this. Well, in fact, all this to ask the following question. Is it possible to conceive of a small group without a telos? Would a little group investing in the utopia of everyday life be viable without some telos? Would a group that is interested in idiorhythmy be conceivable without a general telos? We have to ask the decisive question, isn't there, at the same time, a friendship between idiorhythmy and the absence of telos? In other words, is an idiorhythmic group possible? I won't answer. We're not in a position to answer now. For now, I'll limit the problem to defining it in this way, two or three remarks. There can be, for a group, a very vague cause or telos. For instance, in the hippie communities, happiness One can also meet for the sake of pleasure. Sociability can be an end in itself. Someone has given me the following quotation from Victor Dubled in a book, French Society from the 15th to the 20th century, 1900. The chief concern of people living in the world is sociality. But the world is not interested in love or family or friendship or doing good works. The world brings men together. It wants them to take pleasure in joining together. Everything is set out with that in view. The rest is not its concern. This is an excellent quotation. It's very rigorous. It dismisses the possibility of any telos. The group here is defined as a pure homeostatic machine that runs by itself. It's a closed circuit of charge and expenditure. This is an idyllic view of worldliness. The way of living together is a machine with no goal. There is no transformation. It generates pleasure in its purest form. This is a great hypothesis. Maybe it's a hypothesis that you cannot attack. The pleasure of being together has no origin. It cannot be transformed. The being together would be a sort of primitive of pleasure. One could not analyze this kind of pleasure. It's really the absolute primitive. This homeostatic view of the group is possible in a world without language, a pure utopia. As soon as there is language, if people are together, it's to speak. There is a certain staging, and you have a system of classification, and you have positions, the position you speak from, the position you assign, the position that you presume. There is immediately an elaboration of strategies of enunciation. Some of you will have heard François Flau in the morning seminar about these issues, the linguistics of positions of enunciation. This is the second aspect of worldliness after the utopian aspect. We have the aspect that is better known through the French moralists, I'd say from La Bruyère, La Rochefoucauld, Proust. The idea is that we join together, we live together, not by pleasure, but in order to be recognized. One can only be as long as one is recognized. To quote a book I put in the corpus and I haven't used yet, we see in Zola's potluck. It's a bourgeois apartment building in Paris. There's a group determined by contingencies, motivations relating to money, social class, as well as with the rental of any apartment building, any group of tenants. What's immediately established as soon as they are living together is a shared telos. The common cause from top to bottom of the building, everyone wants to be seen as a figure of respectability. Everybody lives with the others as an idea of respectability. There's a stairwell of false mirrors, and we see this a lot in the novel, the stairwell, the stairs being the place where meetings and interactions happen. We see the reverse of this inside the rooms. If we return to the fantasy of the idiorhythmic group, the idea of living together as a success is the first hypothesis. Living together as homeostasis, as the everlasting preservation of the pure pleasure of sociability. It's a more philosophical manner of shedding worldliness. Worldliness has to be rejected. Worldliness can't be dissociated from competition for position. If we want an idiorhythmic group, we will have the impossible superhuman paradox, establishing a group whose telos would be to destroy itself as a group. The telos of the idiorhythmic group would be to destroy the telos. In Nietzschean terms, it would allow the group to leap beyond any resentment. We still have 10 minutes. I'll say just a few things about the next entry. It's titled The Room. The room is here defined as an enclosed personal space. In Greek, kelion. In Latin, cella. This is the foundation of idiorhythmy. The cella is the foundation of idiorhythmy. But to understand the room, we need to take a wider view, or start from very far on a bigger scale. I will first talk about total space. I will use here indicate my sources. The book, that's a dissertation by an architect, British architect, Joseph Rickwert. Rickwert's dissertation, published last year, is called On Adam's House in Paradise. Indeed, paradise, first meaning, implies the house. Eden, you know what Eden is? Initially, was a domain, a country house. God created Adam and Eve so that they might keep each other company and talk with one another. God created Adam and Eve to speak between themselves and also with him. He didn't create conjugality. The fact that they can talk with him and with themselves means that they walked in the garden in the cool of the day. The garden is for God as well. In Eden, Adam has to cultivate and he has a number of walks. It's the country house. It's a total space. Then there's another phantasmatic configuration of paradise. It is the hut. This is what Rickwert calls Adam's hut. Rickwert's thesis is that Adam's hut, that primitive fantasized hut, was for thousands of years the main model of buildings for all architects. Every architect tries to remake Adam's hut. It's especially true of the architects who work with wood. When architects model timber constructions, they think about Adam's hut. What is interesting in Rickwert's thesis is that the hut, the house, is not a functional determination, like providing shelter, but it is a symbolic operation. It's not only to give shelter in bad weather. It is a symbolic operation. Man creates the house as a space that the subject can interpret through his or her body. The hut is at once body and world, the world as a projection of the body. There are lots of interesting remarks about religious buildings, like the Egyptian temples. They're all based on the diagram of the body. I lived in Egypt and I visited all those temples. There was somebody there, a character, who tried to interpret everything in esoteric terms. he had a book called The Temple in Man. He was showing that all the Egyptian temples were diagrams of the human body. One should follow this direction. We need to understand the house as a symbolic operation. The house can't be understood without reference to the sacred. This is true in paleontology. Le Roi Gourand has documented this. What Le Roi Gourand shows is that there is the concomitant contemporaneous emergence of language and dwelling. One should verify this, but it is clear that there is a certain threshold of symbolization here. A house can't be understood without reference to the sacred. And this is what you see in the scriptures. There are three forms that are revealed, functioning as ideal models for architects. These are variations on Adam's hut. Here are the three forms. First, in the Bible, the first is Noah's Ark. The Ark represents total autarky. It's a compendium of the world, an encyclopedia of all species, the guarantee of reproduction. It will lead to the invention of the family. The Ark is the model for all rural domains. There's a novel that shows its realization. It's the mysterious island. You have the two coordinates with five people on an island, and it's wonderfully described by Jules Verne. We see both how savaging and autarky. Nevertheless, they are destined for catastrophe. No reproduction takes place. The five people will finally found a real colony in Iowa. As a form, Noah's Ark is the direct descendant of Adam's hut. And when God asked this ark to be made, it was to be made of timber. God rebuilds the hut in a more compact version. See you next Wednesday.